Hey, Robert hier. Dieser Podcast wird euch präsentiert von der Hannover Messe. Wir sagen vielen herzlichen Dank an die Kollegen in Hannover. Wir danken euch auch für die coolen Tage in Hannover mit viel Robotik, Automation und KI. Es hat sich wieder einmal gelohnt. Und jetzt geht's los mit dem Podcast. Robotik in der Industrie. Der Podcast mit Helmut Schmidt und Robert Weber. Hallo liebe Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer, willkommen zu einer neuen Folge unseres Podcastes Robotik in der Industrie. Mein Name ist Robert Weber und München sitzt
Helmut Schmidt, grüß euch.
Helmut, bevor wir gleich rübergehen zu unserem US-Korrespondenten und mit ihm ein bisschen über Robotic as a Service sprechen und was er auf der Automate gesehen hat, lass uns einen ganz kurzen aktuellen Teil machen. Du warst auf der Hannover Messe, wie hat's dir gefallen?
Genau, ich bin auf der Hannover Messe gewesen. Ich war erstmal positiv beeindruckt dahingehend, dass insbesondere gleich am ersten Tag, am Montag, der eher verhalten startet, gleich wirklich ziemlich viel Besuch war. Ich bin da einmal mit dem Deutschen Robotikverband aus dem Application Park und einmal mit Inok Robotics vor Ort gewesen. Und das muss ich sagen, war durchgehend positiv, also der komplette Robotic Application Park war positiv. Es waren offene Stände, gute Firmen, gute Startups, gute Stimmung, offenes Miteinander. Das hat mir gut gefallen. Auch die Gespräche waren positiv, die Stimmungslage war gut. Was ich Fragezeichen hinsichtlich stelle, ist aus Robotik- und Automatisierungssicht, ist, es haben viele Große tatsächlich gefehlt. Und das in einem Nicht-Automatiker-Jahr und viele Asiaten sind präsent gewesen. Ich würde jetzt schlussfolgern, ein bisschen leichtfertig dem Wettbewerb den Platz überlassen. Also das habe ich tatsächlich erstaunt. Ansonsten war es wirklich gute Stimmung, gute Gespräche, gute Geschäfte.
3.800 Euro Cobot gab es auch, ne? Der hat mir auch zu denken gegeben.
Absolut, das ist eine Ansage und das war jetzt kein Low-Cost-Plastik- oder Kunststoffroboter, ohne jetzt Ego zu nahe zu treten, sondern es ist ein tatsächlicher, vollwertiger Industriekobot. Am Ende der Messe hätte man wahrscheinlich für 2.500 sogar mit nach Hause nehmen können.
Ja, genau, ich habe nämlich gefragt.
Ja, genau, du hast gefragt. Also das ist eine tatsächliche Ansage. Es sind andere Koreaner, Asiaten, Chinesen.
Taiwanesen
sind vor Ort gewesen. Es gab auch einige, die auch modulare Roboter gezeigt haben. Also neben Beckhoff und Robco gibt's andere, die an einem ähnlichen Konzept arbeiten. Aber eben alle aus dem Ausland. Und das hat mich erstaunt. Es tut sich nach wie vor wahnsinnig viel in dem Robotik- und Cobots-Bereich. Und deswegen positive Stimmung.
Wir hatten ja auch zur Eröffnung die Delta-Story mit ihren Delta-Cobots. Ja. Da war auch richtig Musik da am Stand, in dem Delta-Stand. Riesiger Stand, ich glaube Halle 11.
Ja.
Also aus dem asiatischen Bereich war da richtig Musik da. Ja.
Es war wirklich was da und wie du sagst, mit Delta vorgestellt, aus einer Hand eine komplette Familie sofort verfügbar und nicht nur technologisch verfügbar, sondern auch lieferbar. Produziert und entwickelt in Deutschland, in Europa. Und das zeigt natürlich schon, dass die anderen Hersteller, für die die Hannover Messe noch wichtig ist, sich hier einen Footprint zogen, um sich zu positionieren. Also das war durchaus positiv. Und gerade die Stimmung auf dem Application Park, das hat das Team auch gut gemacht.
War wirklich, ja, das fand ich richtig gut, auch mit der Bar und so, mit den kostenlosen Getränken und so. Das war einfach gut gelöst. Ja. Und wir haben mal mit dem Philipp Becker von Vision Laser Technik gesprochen. Der war nämlich auch auf der Messe. Das spiele ich jetzt mal ganz kurz ein. Was habt ihr auf der Hannover Messe 2024 gezeigt?
Ja, mein Name ist Philipp Becker. Ich bin von Vision Laser Technik, hier vertreten mit Vision Robotik. Und wir sind erstmalig auf dem Application Park, dieses Jahr auf der Hannover Messe. Und wir haben hier eine echte Neuheit mitgebracht, nämlich das erste Mal, dass ein Laserschweißsystem gekoppelt oder geführt von einem Cobot, von einem Leichtbauroboter, auch für kleine und mittlere Serien Schweißaufgaben übernehmen könnt.
Was ist der USP im Vergleich zu Marktanwendungen?
Ja, wir sind Maschinenbauer und bisher haben wir entweder komplett manuelle oder automatische Schweißsysteme produziert. Wir haben aber immer mehr das Problem, dass unsere Kunden sagen, ja, ich brauche diese Anlagen, aber ich finde keine Schweißer mehr. Liefert mir eine Anlage und liefert mir die Schweißer. Und jetzt haben wir eine Möglichkeit gefunden, wie wir jedem, auch Angelernten, die Möglichkeit geben können, Schweißaufgaben komplett automatisiert mit Hilfe von maschinellem Lernen, mit gut hinterlegten Programmen und eben mit Leichtbaurobotik, das für alle zugänglich zu machen.
Und ist das ein Nachrüstset oder ist das eine komplette Zelle? Wie kann ich mir das vorstellen?
Das ist eine komplette Zelle. Die gibt es in verschiedenen Größen, je nach Bauteilgröße. Die gibt es sowohl als offenes Lasersystem, aber auch als geschlossenes Lasersystem. Und es ist für den Kunden eine Neuanschaffung, allerdings mit einem sehr schnellen Return on Invest, weil ich kann mir den Arbeitnehmer sparen.
Was hältst du vom Application Park? Wie ist so dein Fazit nach jetzt einer Woche Hannover Messe?
Der Application Park ist toll. Wir haben jetzt die Möglichkeit, dass wir hier nicht nur Komponenten ausstellen, sondern auch ganze Applikationen zeigen können. Und das ist für uns als Aussteller natürlich toll, weil wir den Kunden wirklich zeigen können, was unsere Maschinen und Anlagen machen. Aber eben auch für die Besucher hervorragend, weil sie auch die richtige Anwendung schon erleben können.
Messe heißt immer Leads gezählt. Gut oder schlecht?
Wir sind im Investitionsbereich. Das heißt, wir sehen die qualifizierten und guten Leads immer erst ein bisschen später. Aber wir haben jetzt schon nach den ersten Tagen gesehen, dass das wirklich auf dem Application Park ein wirklicher Gewinnbringer ist, weil wir Leute haben, die wirklich mit klaren Applikationswünschen zu uns kommen.
Danke dir.
Dankeschön.
So, und jetzt gehen wir von der Hannover Messe im Hauptteil. Gehen wir in die USA zu Automate. Da hatten wir auch Intrinsic mit DeepMind. Dosan stellt neue Geschichten vor. Viele amerikanische Unternehmen, die auch was zeigen, auch Unternehmen, die uns so, wo wir gar nicht wussten, ob die schon Roboter haben oder nicht. Aber der Stu hat gesagt, dass da vor allem Investoren viele auf der Messe waren und sich umgeschaut haben. Das hat mich dann schon überrascht. Investoren.
Ja, ja. Das ist erstaunlich. Auf der anderen Seite, es ging ja kürzlich über den Aether Collaborative Robotics aus den USA und die 100 Millionen Euro geraced haben.
Ja.
Und das zeigt, dass die Stimmungslage und wahrscheinlich genau deswegen die Investoren auf Suche sind im amerikanischen Markt. Was gibt es an neuen Firmen? Was gibt es an neuen Technologien, wo das Geld platziert werden kann, wo sich tatsächlich unsere europäischen und deutschen Firmen noch relativ schwer tun.
Aber das fand ich spannend, weil wenn ihr gleich hört im Hauptteil, wenn ich dann höre, wie konservativ dann aber die US-Unternehmen sind, also Robotic as a Service ist
nicht zusammen.
Null, kein Thema bei den Kunden. So auf der einen Seite die Finanzwelt und auf der anderen Seite die konservativen Anwender, die vielleicht noch konservativer sind als unsere in Europa. Das fand ich schon krass.
Ist super interessant, vor allem, weil die Investoren setzen ja auf Recurring Revenue, setzen auf Robotic as a Service. Und jetzt hört man genau, das ist ein Thema, was nur bedingt gut läuft, weil der Markt vielleicht doch ein bisschen konservativer ist. Entweder haben die Investoren etwas mehr Mut oder glauben eher an das Thema, dass es kommen wird. Aber da passt das eine mit dem anderen nicht so 100% zusammen. Aber für die Stimmungslage ist es gut. Und die positive Stimmung der Investorenseite, wer für deutsche Startups Seed, Pre-Seed, Series A super wichtig, dass das hier rüber schwappt, damit wir da ähnliche Tickets signen können.
So, und jetzt gehen wir in den Hauptteil zum Stu. A warm welcome to Stu in the USA. Stu, welcome to the podcast, our USA correspondent.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Stu, before we go into the main part, let's start talking about Automate. Who or what surprised you most at the trade fair?
Well, it was a significant growth over the previous year. Okay. I think they said that they had estimated it was more than a 30% increase in attendance.
Wow.
So it was more than 40,000. I heard a number around 44, but I don't know what the official figures were, but 44,000 people was a significant increase over the previous year. And of course, the trade show was significantly larger as far as the total number of exhibitors. The show was moved from Detroit to Chicago in McCormick Place, and we had the entire South Hall, and it was full. It was very busy. People were excited and talking about their automation projects. And I think the thing that surprised me the most was the number of investors that were on the floor looking to make connections to either acquire companies or investigate the space to see if it was safe to invest and other things like that. And it was an amazing show. It was by far the best automation show I've been at in a very, very long time.
Very interesting, because we just saw the latest IFR numbers published for 2023, which show the increase in the United States about, I think, plus 12%, 45,000 robots installed. Is this more or less the positive attitude you were just talking or shown at the Automate, that the drive, the spirit is back to the market or back to robotics?
Yeah, so I think there's three things at work here. One is there was a reported downturn in order intake in the fourth quarter of last year and the first quarter of this year. I think that was a momentary pause as people tried to get the equipment they'd purchased installed and up and running, and some people had overpurchased during COVID and things were resetting a bit. But I think that the demand is very strong and people's plans have moved forward, even with some of the changes in the EV market that's kind of settling out finally. But I think the biggest thing is automation is now considered to be acceptable. In the past, a lot of people said, oh, don't throw robots in, you'll create unemployment. Well, we now have proof that that's not the case. And also we have proof that there's not enough employees available to fill the total number of jobs that are out there. And also the automation is available is easier to use and easier to deploy and easier to install and use than it's ever been before. And I think that's bringing new people into the market that'll continue to drive market growth.
From a technological perspective, what convinced you?
Well, I don't know if I'm the one to be convinced. I've been a long-term advocate of automation, but what I'm hearing from customers is that they are seeing evidence of robots going into companies that look like theirs, and they feel like there's less risk. There's lots of articles published about ease of use and deployment, but I think the biggest thing that's holding people back is the perceived economics of automation and the risk of just a disruption of starting it up, starting automation up in their plant in general. You know, are they ready themselves for automation? And I think that's an area where it would be good for all of us as an industry to speak, because even with the economics in the U.S. being as strong as they are right now, the return on investment in properly deployed automation is far greater than what you can get in the stock market today.
You mentioned your customers. Which industry, what kind of people are they and what they are looking for?
So it's pretty widespread. The thing that's great about automation today is it's moved far past the automotive and automotive component area than it has in the past. It's also moved past large companies, and certainly large companies are still deploying robots. But I think the big thing is that small to mid-sized companies of all types are reaching in and starting to see the benefits of automation, even small machine shops or fabricators, small manufacturers, co-packing firms, and others, not just the big warehouses, not just the big manufacturers.
Mm-hmm. Can you share with us how the Asians and Europeans did at the trade fair show?
So it was interesting. This was probably the largest concentration of people that have participated in the show from Asia, from an exhibitor's perspective. There are many new Chinese players that have come into the market with mostly cobots and AMRs was what we saw here at the show. Also, there was a couple of new European-based robot manufacturers, cobot manufacturers, and AMRs that came into the North American market. I think in the past, this was somewhat constrained because we were dealing with COVID and then the massive shipping delays. You know, some of these exhibits require land-sea containers, and this time last year, we were still in the middle of the crisis of shipping and, you know, issues of getting ships unloaded and transportation taken care of. But so this year, all of that was resolved, certainly. And there was a significant increase for sure from Asia, all over Asia, not just China, but, you know, throughout the Asia Pacific market. And there's a couple new players from Germany, and then a reinforcement of a number of companies that had come here already, but it was clear that they were better established and finally ready to do business in North America.
Very, very, very cool. One question on my side, because you also said what you surprised most is you saw many investment companies. We just saw some big investments in the United States, in U.S. companies, in humanoids, but also in a company called Cobots. Were humanoids present? I mean, in the press, they are all present, but have they been present at the Automate as well? Or did anyone show the humanoids?
Yeah, there were some. I mean, the show is largely an industrial show, and there's a lot of people with humanoid intentions that I'm not sure this is the right show for them. I mean, they could be here. But the humanoid presence was limited, but also the market at this point is still limited. It's still, I think we're a few years away from seeing humanoids being effectively deployed. The business use cases are still a little bit limited at this point, and also the availability and support of the technology is a little bit limited. But I think it's something that will emerge over time. Some people believe it's as close as 5 years. I think it's a little bit further than that for humanoids.
Okay, so humanoids was a topic, but what was the, when you talked to your customers, when you talked to the exhibitors, what was the, let's say, the top three topics at the trade fair show?
The top three topics were, one was clearly the availability of manpower. And that was causing people to look at automation who perhaps have never looked at automation before. So that was clearly the number one topic. The number two topic probably was related to how well supported some of these companies really are. You know, there's some interest in some startup companies and some younger companies. The question is, are they ready to really support large deployments?
Are they reliable, you mean?
Yeah, reliable from a supplier perspective. Yeah, exactly. And then also there was a lot of discussion around just the economics of the whole thing. You know, most technical discussions eventually wind up with a business use case, and there are still many applications that the business use case is just not there yet. But there's also many customers that are trying to figure out, have they been evaluating the business use cases correctly? Because certainly the unemployment situation is not going to get any better in the foreseeable future. And, you know, how and when do you start? And the discussions I try to lead is, you know, start with a reasonable amount of automation. Don't go crazy and try to do the whole plant, but at least do a starter job and somewhat go from a crawl to a walk to a run rather than jumping straight to a sprint when it comes to deployment.
But I think that's very interesting, this the topic to be a reliable supplier for U.S. customers. How difficult is that for the startup companies in the U.S. and in Europe, Asia?
Well, the challenge is that a lot of startup companies start in a single location. So even that initial location can be a problem, because if you're on the East Coast or the West Coast of the United States, you've got several time zones. And then likewise, just the travel logistics within the United States is somewhat challenging. So a lot of European companies and some Asian companies forget about their geography lessons, about the relative size of not only the U.S., but also Canada and Mexico, because the economies of Canada and Mexico are very closely coupled to the U.S., as are some of the manufacturers.
And in the end, customers will buy from Fano Kuka or URI again? Or are they're impressed by the technology? Okay, I like it, but at the end, I will buy from the manufacturers I know, I trust.
Well, yes and no. There's certainly, you know, preference in a lot of cases for the installed base, but or the existing well-developed companies like the Fanex and Yaskawas and ABBs and even UR is finally pretty well deployed here in the States. But they are willing to take on risk, again, if the economic model is there to justify taking such a risk. And if the company that's there is able to actually support the equipment effectively, because sometimes first movers can get an advantage. You might be able to get some lower cost early deployment type stuff to assist in development. But the companies that are risk adverse, that want the equipment to run immediately, are more likely to go with an established company or at least established integrators that are trusted, that may be using some new technology. But they trust the integrators not to let them fall down.
But what is an advantage that you see? What can you use to set yourself apart in the USA?
As far as being an OEM manufacturer?
Yes.
Yeah. So the way to set yourself apart is one, validate that the equipment you have and what you're providing works, and then have a assigned team that's committed to working with the end customer to not only launch the product, but to sustain the product longer term after the initial launch point. Because a lot of times startup companies will get across the finish line of shipping a piece of equipment, you know, take a deep breath and then move on to the next job and forget about the customer that they deployed the first job and maybe not take care of them as well. So that's a large part of it. But the other thing is it really starts with preparation. Mm-hmm. The idea of training, as an example, has changed dramatically with the acceptance of online training in recent years, kind of driven by COVID. And most users today don't use manuals and won't even really look at online tech help. You know, so a strong presence in YouTube or Instagram or other things where you've got short lessons that are video enabled and other technology that's available, online diagnostics and other tools to allow the customer to help themselves is super important, especially for a young company. Because you just can't afford to wait for a technician to come from the other side of the country. Flight delays with weather. We're having terrible weather in the United States these days. So the delay of getting people to the site is just not acceptable. So a new company needs to look at how can they efficiently demonstrate their equipment online and support their equipment online to the extent possible, because that's what even the best-in-class companies are doing today.
Helmut?
What I thought, Stu, is many startups or new market leader or market players try to build up a dealer network first. I mean, I go to the United States, or I'm even a United States startup. What I don't have normally is a sales force. I don't have technicians. I maybe have a small backup, but I have. Well, I like to build up a dealer network who is already established to cover all the open questions you just mentioned. But now I understood, okay, the dealer network or a possible new dealer network is only one part to solve the problem. It's even more important that the startup itself is present.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, startups have not done a very good job of supporting their distribution network, which makes the customers very unhappy. Okay. Makes the distributors very unhappy, in fact, as well, because they're frustrated and they don't have time to deal with all the OEM's issues. You know, important thing to remember about a lot of distributors is they have a very broad line card. So their resources are diluted across a large number of different products. And the products that are most interesting, if they don't have support, wind up being very problematic, and it's impossible for a distributor to be an expert at everything, especially a brand new OEM's product, and even more so if that brand new OEM's product's not well supported.
Mm-hmm. So I want to come back to your customers, because they are now home again in their factory, in their production plants, and now they have to ask themselves, what should I buy now? Which solution will actually be sold in the USA? What kind of solutions?
Well, there's certainly all types of solutions, but the first stop when they get back home needs to be is to review their budget and understand what they're looking at.
How big is their budget in the USA?
Well, it's millions and millions of dollars for sure, but at an individual company, it may be anywhere from zero to you know, a million or more. Because the issue is a lot of companies may not have planned for automation and they have to kind of reboot their budget. And this is almost the midpoint of the year. So depending on what their fiscal year is, they may or may not have money in their fiscal budget this year, but they need to plan for money into their budget for next year or get funding from their private equity owners or get funding from whoever they're trying to get funding from. And then some companies have to just work on the fundamentals, just funding, period. They may not have the resources they believe to get out there and actually invest in automation. The truth is, in a lot of cases, when it comes to investment, again, if they start small, they're probably burning more cash than they realize. And if they can divert that cash that they're burning into useful automation that's, again, small, digestive chunk, then they may be able to actually make deployments this year.
I also have a short question if I'm the customer, because you also mentioned a interesting topic on the automate. You said, okay, there were a lot of new market players, but also a lot of mobile robotics, AGVs and AMRs. Do you see a shift I mean, not a shift from buying either a mobile robots or buying a stationary robot, but a shift in, let's say the growth rate maybe is higher on mobile robots because maybe they just get in place. Or how you see this, because this is what surprised me when you said, okay, there were many AGVs and mobile robot manufacturers at the automate as well.
Yes. Which
would indicate also the market for mobile robots is growing, or at least have the same potential, growth potential.
Who should buy all these AMRs?
Yeah, so one of the reasons why there's so many AMRs, frankly, is they're pretty easy to build, and the technology to create an AMR is much more available than it's ever been before. You know, guidance systems are less of an issue, and battery life and battery availability is better. So AMRs are pretty easy to create. There's also a very wide range of AMRs, everything from very simple carts to full-blown AMRs or even automated fork trucks. All of these technologies have been driven forward very quickly by the large warehouse players. And the large warehouse players are buying, you know, maybe hundreds of these things. But even small companies can buy one or two. And they're starting to experiment. And there's, again, certainly lots of companies that are out there. I believe there'll be a consolidation in some of those companies and some mergers and acquisitions in that area. Because I don't believe that any one AMR is a real breakout per se at this particular point. And there's, you know, interesting challenges because it's not just the AMR technology, but if you're running a warehouse, it's how do you integrate it to your warehouse management systems. But in a small manufacturer, if you're only using one or two AMRs, you don't have to worry about a warehouse management system. Sometimes you just program the unit by walking it to its point of destination and telling it to return and programming in a handful of different simple routes. So like anything else, AMRs will increase in use as the ease of use continues to improve and the cost effectiveness comes in and people start to understand how much time is wasted in intercompany or interfacility plant material handling. And even AMRs are starting to show up in the truck lots for moving trailers outside of the shipping dock area in the actual truck yard. We're starting to see some deployments in that area. And I think that's another exciting area if they can figure out how to manage the weather.
Mm-hmm. Are there financial incentives in the USA to invest in robotics?
Not really, not in robotics specifically. I mean, you really have to go it alone to make sure that the financial part makes sense. But there are some capital equipment investment deductions that are available through the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, as it's known. There's an item called Section 179, which is a tax credit that's associated with the deductions of CapEx-type equipment. And that is used well by companies that understand how to use it and follow the rules of how do you take advantage of that. And there's some limited funding available, but most of the funding in the U.S. that's robotics or automation related is in the education market, frequently referred to as STEM, or science, technology, engineering, and math. And the STEM-related activities and investments are significant. And there's lots of robots being deployed at universities and trade schools and high schools and even elementary schools, trying to build up the knowledge of the available and interested students to make them more employable when they come out and hopefully to drive interest in automation. So that's where the big investments from government are going at the moment, aside from research into, you know, things like the DARPA type activities, and even those are starting to wane because a lot of the DARPA projects are actually turning into reality with self-driving vehicles and other types of mobility is starting to show up.
Mm-hmm. Let's look a little bit at the end into the future. What are your customers concerned about in the next months, maybe?
Some of them are concerned about the presidential election that's coming up.
Is it so important for the automation market?
Yeah, well, it's a fun discussion because a lot of people hold off on investments until they see is it a Republican or Democrat that gets into the White House. But studies going clear back to 1955 have proven that there's been no change of investment mm-hmm. in gross domestic product or automation or anything else like that related to one group in the White House or the other. The only exception might be in electric vehicles. There's one that's leaning harder towards EVs than the other. But in general, the automation market is agnostic of political parties. So the biggest issue is the availability of finances, and can people find the money and make the financial justification? Because so much of the discussion at trade shows and by salespeople are around the technology and not around the economics. And I think there needs to be a fundamental shift in how companies talk about their products and how companies talk about selling their automation to truly understand it really has to be a financial business use case. And the best use case, the best financial result is what should win the project. But right now, everybody's just battling over, you know, cool technology or basic throughput or basic installation costs.
And will we see new financial instruments by U.S. robotics companies, or what is your propose?
Well, I don't propose anything in that regard, but there's already financial instruments that are out there. So the robot companies, in some cases, will refer to a company to a leasing organization. And there's some automation integrators and others that are trying to offer robots as a service. And yeah. Robots as a service may work in other countries, but with the way the tax code and other things work in the United States, it's not been very popular. There's lots of people trying it, trying to treat automation like a fork truck or other types of vehicles that you can lease. But the leasing model is different because there's so much non-reoccurring engineering and also installation and deinstallation costs that creep into the robot as a service model or into the leasing model. Because all that cost of installation or deinstallation, if you take it out, and all the non-reoccurring engineering has to be borne by that specific project. Whereas if you're leasing a fork truck or other type of standard vehicle, you know, you can bring it in on a flatbed truck, push it off and leave it there for, you know, however long the lease period is, and then pick it up at the end of the lease period and take it out. So I don't know if robot as a service is ever going to be financially popular, because the other issue is most chief financial officers or finance people in general do not like reoccurring monthly charges for items that depreciate over time, and also for items that have a not only a depreciation but an obsolescence rate.
But was that a topic at the Automate, new financial instruments like robots as a service, or?
Well, it's always been a topic. There's been a lot of companies trying to use that as their differential, as their a way to attract people in. And then also with the private equities there, they all are interested in robots as a service, because if their company can figure out the reoccurring revenue market and not be lumpy, as they say, with order intake being all over the place, but a steady stream of growth, and can get some kind of a subscription model going, it's very popular, because from a financial risk perspective for the owners, it reduces their risk. But it's just not really in the last 15 years that those models have been around, those models have not been largely successful.
Helmut, that's surprising, because we thought that it would work first in the USA to do a robot as a service.
Yeah, absolutely. And first, let's say, mainly startup driven, we're trying to get the fundraising on a robotic as a service. But it seems not to take off as easily as it was assumed. It looks so.
I mean, it makes great financial sense for the academics, but in practice, it doesn't work out so well. And then the other thing is that a lot of these companies are trying to offer robots as a service may not necessarily be the long, stable companies. And companies are afraid if they, you know, choose robots as a service, what happens if that company collapses? You know, in my past life, and some companies I've worked with some major software installations and robot installations, we actually had to put the software packages into a safe location for the customer and have an accrual and everything set up around it for long-term sustainability. And if a company is young and does not look stable, then the idea of marrying yourself to that company worries companies, because what happens if that company doesn't make it and in fact collapses? Then you're out there on your own with a piece of equipment that's not serviceable in your plant.
Stu, are U.S. companies much more conservative than we think in Europe?
So, yes and no. There's a couple of things that drive it. It's a very interesting question, actually. I think that the costs of doing business in Europe are higher, so I think the Europeans are a little bit more aggressive in deploying automation, and certainly we've seen high aggression of deployment in China. So I think, yes, the U.S. consumers are a little bit more conservative, but I think the other thing that factors into all of that is that the pricing that companies come to the U.S. with typically is higher than the rest of the world. And on a robot-by-robot basis, you know, it's not uncommon that you can buy robots cheaper in China or Europe than what you can buy in the U.S. And I wonder if companies have gotten a little bit too greedy with the price of some of this automation to make it work. But the price of the robot is less of a factor when you total in the factor cost of automation, because customers look at the total price, not just the individual robot prices. But for sure, the robot and AMR prices, if they're high here, will continue to escalate the noise. So, you know, foreign companies are coming into the U.S. right now offering lower price solutions, trying to differentiate themselves from the established groups. But again, that presents risk, because do they have enough money to, you know, create the support that's necessary to keep their equipment running in North America?
Helmut, last question to you.
Yeah, one question for Marisa, because you said technology, usability, training, education is important. Then, of course, the financing and financial models important. What's about, as final, because this is always a problem, or sometimes a problem in Germany, it's about regulations, risk analysis, certification. And you just mentioned maybe the United States is also a little bit conservative. Is the regulations or the ANSI, the ISO certification, is this a topic or a showstopper or a problem, or just it's part that need to be solved?
Well, so this year you'll actually see a harmonization in a lot of the standards between Europe and the U.S. So it'll be less of a discussion point going forward. The ISO 10218 is being broadly adopted. They're going through voting now, and they'll be voting in the U.S. on adopting that into the RA 1506. So the standards and the risks and those kinds of things are similar. The OSHA safety regulations and other things like that are very similar. So most customers assume that either the manufacturer or the integrator know what they're doing, which is a risky assumption, I might add. A lot of companies kind of ignore it until they get to their plant and then they realize they may have a problem. So the thing that's kind of interesting about the whole safety thing is if you do a risk assessment early in the process, at the very beginning of the project, even before you do a quotation to the marketplace, you can identify what the risks are. And if you do it well, it actually reduces the total cost of the system, because eliminates a lot of the contingencies, or helps you eliminate some of the things that could have been risks, and you would buy them differently and plan differently, knowing what the risks are. But with a lot of the pre-engineered cells that are coming out from the integrators and even robot manufacturers, a lot of those safety and risk issues are now more resolved in advance, because they've planned it into their standard offering. You know, it used to be people didn't think you could weld with a cobot. Well, you can, and you can do it well, but you have to use it correctly, and you have to buy it from a integrator that paid attention to the safety standards and made sure that the robotic system was made compliant with the current safety standards. So I think robot companies and robot integrators have gotten better at it. End users are more aware of it, but also they kind of assume that it comes, even though it may not, with the system. But I think overall, people are, again, robotics are now acceptable in the marketplace compared to what they were before. And a lot of the risk factors are resolved or have been resolved. And when you look at the safety record within the robotics industry compared to other industries and even automobiles and other things, the safety within the robotics industry is exceptional. There's very few injuries and very few fatalities in robotics overall compared to even consumer appliances or a bunch of other things. So the risk is not there from the safety point of view for people who plan and deploy equipment properly.
Stu, thank you very much. What's on your agenda for the next week?
Interesting. I'm following up on all the leads from Automate, frankly, which is
investors or what?
Well, there are some investors.
What is your hot lead? What is a hot lead for you?
A hot lead is a company that's in trouble and wants to grow their business and wants to get it rolling. So most of my stuff is related to robot OEMs and integrators and helping them. Although I do have a couple of end users.
How many hot leads do you have?
Oh, well, I would say ones that are addressable.
Okay.
That will be business in the next quarter. I probably have at least 12. And for a small company like us, that's pretty good.
Okay.
But some of these leads will take some time to evolve. But I also had a number of existing customers on the trade show floor, so we continue to push that business forward. So I'm not concerned about growth for our business. I'm concerned about being responsive to the clients that are looking to get business done, and also trying to differentiate tire kickers versus people that are people of action. Because that's always an interesting thing. At trade shows, you have this thing called trade show hysteria or trade show euphoria. And it always sounds better at the show, and then reality sinks in. But frankly, unlike past shows, the demand for automation is so great right now that I see the interest after the show continuing to escalate and will continue for several years to come.
We wish you all the best, Stu. Thank you very much, and greetings to the USA.
Thanks. Pleasure to be with you again.
All the best. Thanks, Stu.
Bye-bye. The book.